have to post that. So
I can turn the password off before I send it out. So
Diana,
I'll check
is
it.
Here. Hi, Diana.
Hey.
Yay.
How are you, Vicki?
Great.
Finally got it to work.
That's wonderful. So, and Lisa's here. Yay. Yeah, welcome to the techie world where nothing works and everything is hard.
Right.
There's Lisa. There we go. And I still don't know who Kevin is. So, Kevin, please let me know.
Okay. All right. Are you all set?
I think it says we're recording and all is good. So.
Okay. Then I'm out. You guys have a good class.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Bye.
So, welcome everybody. Let me see if I can get the PowerPoint going. So let's see. So from beginning. Okay, can everybody see the slideshow?
Yes.
Yay. So welcome to week four, everybody. We've staggered through 3 weeks. We have found new things to do wrong in Zoom every week, and hopefully this week everything will actually work well. I am knocking on wood right now. So, anybody remember what we did last week?
Dust Bowl.
Well, no, we're doing Dust Bowl this week. So, in college situations, they like us to do what's called a flipped class. And that means, you know, back when you were in public school, the teacher told you stuff, and then you went and did homework on that stuff the teacher had just told you. In college, they like it to be the opposite. You guys do your research ahead of time, and then we get together in class and talk about the research that you guys did. So that's a flipped classroom. So today we talk about the Dust Bowl. Yay! We've talked about it before. Last week we did biodiversity, and the most important single slide out of biodiversity is that the cause for extinction of different species is habitat alteration. We see that with the polar bears. They can't sneak up on the seals on top of the sea ice because the sea ice is melting. So they are basically starving to death. Invasive species. We talked about the European bees that came to America and basically killed off all of the American bees. And so all of the bees that we have nowadays are European bees, except for they're now being taken over by the African bees. Pollution, obviously, we talked about fish who could not survive the pollution from industries that built along the rivers and put toxic chemicals and even just warm water into the river. A lot of fish can't survive when that happens. Population pressure from humans. Obviously, some critters would just as soon not live next to us, and so they have to go someplace else. And there's getting to be fewer and fewer other places to go. And over harvesting, we talked about the buffalo. They didn't go extinct because thankfully they do taste good, but we certainly have killed off all of the wild buffalo. So, any questions? And if not, let's go out to the discussion board and answer our question of the day. And I think the question of the day is, yes. So you guys have been looking at what happened during the Dust Bowl. You've also been experiencing what happens under COVID-19. So I ask you to share some similarities and differences between what people experienced during the Dust Bowl and what you are experiencing nowadays. So, and hi, Trent. I don't know if I actually got to say hi to you when you came on. So welcome to the mob.
Thank you.
Hi, still everybody.
Still got
I
camera
was just
fix.
About to say, guess who we're missing, Boakay. And I was concerned because I know you're always nervous about the technology. So welcome, Boakay.
I got lost in the discussion board. I said, I got to go to the email to be able to join. I have to click on your own email. Here I am.
I'm glad you're here. So you guys may hear me occasionally coughing in the background. It's not COVID-19, it's allergies. So all of those beautiful trees blooming out there just do an awful number on me. But I wouldn't change them for the world. So, and anybody who can see the chat, has Kevin posted who he is yet? No, okay. Kevin, please let me know who you are. I've got Luke, maybe? Is that you possibly, Luke? I'm looking at people who have not told me that they're at home, or sorry, that they're at work while this is going on. So, So everybody got their discussion board posting done?
No, I was in the middle of reading it. When I look at the time, I say, it's already 2:39.
Well, I'm glad. This is probably the most important part. So we will hopefully continue with the slides. So we're going to talk about, everybody's been asking me about the project because I've been dropping subtle hints for the last 3 weeks. And people go, okay, but what's the details? Well, the details, of course, were out in the addendum, but, you know, who pays that much attention to the addendum? I wouldn't either if I was in your position. So out on the learning materials under the project, I have a document you can open up that shows all of the details of the project. You're going to do research in some topic in environmental science, and I think you can see that it's really easy to use just about any topic you want and find some linkage to environmental science. So that shouldn't be a limiting factor in whatever you want to do. We're going to, you know, typically we do it as a presentation in class, but since not everybody can attend the Zoom session and not everybody, you don't actually need a video, I'm thinking. I don't really know. We haven't tested that hypothesis yet, but I think not. But anyhow, it wouldn't be fair under present conditions to require you guys to do the presentation. So you're going to just put together a PowerPoint, and then at some point I'm going to put together a probably a discussion board where you post, each one of you post your PowerPoint, and that will be the project that we do. Slides that you need to include, you have to of course have a title slide where you have what you're doing, your name, the date the project is due, which is June 2nd, 2020, as you can see at the top of the sheet here, and the class, Science 201, Environmental Science. So you lose points if you don't include all four of those things. And surprisingly enough, there's always whole bunches of people who don't do that. And that's the simplest thing. You have to have a slide where you explain what your research question is. This is a science class, and so you're supposed to be answering a question. So a question is going to have a question mark at the end of it. That's how you let me know that you've done that. And then I also want you to tell me a sort of a background bit of information, why you wanted to do this particular project, why you wanted to answer that particular question, why you thought it would be interesting. Then you need to have some background information, especially on research. There's going to be some history behind what you're looking into, or some, you know, family relationship, as Peyton was explaining with her project, the second week of class with the Colorado floods. Then you have to have the results that you actually found, and that's of course going to be the meat of your report. Back when you were doing projects in public school, that would have been your report. Now we have to, in a college environment, surround that report by several layers of other things too. And then I want you to summarize everything. This is the part that people forget, but remember, that's one of the critical parts of the scientific method, is to look back, and that's your look back. Then you have references. Your references are going to include, obviously, the URLs or books that you got your information from. If you have any pictures in your PowerPoint, each one of those has to be cited on the page, and then cite that again in the, or put that again into the references section. And then you have to include a class reference. So if you look about two-thirds of the way down the page, it says you must include four references, one for the source of information, one for your class, and then it has French Vicky 2020 SCI 201 class lecture on, and then you'll type in whatever it is that is the topic that kind of relates to what you did.
What if there isn't any?
Well, obviously there is.
So what's the topic?
Your topic.
Yes.
You pick it. You know I don't tell you what your topic is. This is college. You are supposed to think for yourself. You're not supposed to be little robots doing what the teacher tells you to do. You're supposed to go, oh, I'm really interested in, I know you're interested in cooking and gardening. So you can easily find something to talk about in cooking or gardening or something like that, that would be an environmental science topic. So, by the way, Boisquet is a really good cook. So sadly, we're not all together because she usually brings samples in for us to taste. So
yeah, I'm so sleepy right now because I ate too much of that Japanese stir-fried udon noodles. I ate the whole plate at 1 o'clock.
You didn't even share with sweet hubby?
I'm so sleepy around 2 o'clock. Oh boy.
Okay, well, we're glad you crawled in anyway. So, okay. So one way, Tina always points this out when she comes in, and she'll be back in later when we talk about how to do a PowerPoint, but she always points out that, you know, the way to get an A on something like this is to follow all the rules, and most specifically have more references, because, you know, if say you've got 20 references, and I've had several people who had more than 20 references in because they had a whole lot of pictures or something. And, you know, I'm only requiring four. So that means out of the 20, 16 of them were extra. That's 16 extra credit points. So this is something you can control to get yourself some extra credit points. Hint, hint, hint. After we get these all posted in the discussion board. Then the following week, I'll have everybody go out and look at them all. Since we've got 22, that's kind of mean. So probably what will happen is I will assign you guys to look at specific ones, but it could be that only 10 people actually like turn it in. So, so in that case, it won't be quite so bad. So anyhow, you'll be looking at them and telling me what you think. And that will be the project analysis, which is the big homework assignment for week 10. So any questions about the projects at this point? I see Trent shaking his head. I see Diana shaking her head. Okay, so going to close that out. I'm going to show you one more thing. Let's see. Stop share. And let's see if I can get out. I'm going to show you guys my website because I hide all sorts of interesting things out there. So let's see. Come on, share screen. Share screen. Why is that not there? Ah, there it is. Okay. Okay. Can everybody see vf-tropi.com?
Yes.
Okay. This is my website, VF for Vicki French. Notice up at the top of it, there's materials for statistics class. Well, that's not you guys. Materials for science class. Well, that might be tempting, but you're actually the environmental science class. So let's go there. And there I'll have interesting things posted periodically, including right at the moment, I've got three PowerPoints that students in past classes. Hey, Luke, there's Luke again. Luke is in our class again because of various insanity relating to the military. So Luke's already done his project, and Peyton's already done her project, although it's not posted yet. But these will give you a good idea of what exactly I'm looking for. So, for example, let me pull up Mary's. See if this actually shows up. Can you guys see why Alaskan fisheries?
No, yeah.
No, okay. So I'll have to stop sharing that one. Start sharing this one. Okay, there we go. Okay, so this was, oops. Ah, go away. Slideshow from beginning. So Mary Elder was a student, as you can see, in 2017. And she used to work in the Alaskan fisheries. That's, you know, something that doesn't often happen in Colorado, that we have a student who works in Alaskan fisheries. But she talks about, well, first of all, here's the title page. She's got her topic, her name, the class, the date that it was due. She's saying, you know, why she's interested in it. And she wants to show the difference between wild and farm-raised fisheries and the different impacts that they have. Notice this is a picture of her, and she's got herself cited at the bottom of the page, MK Alder 2017. And there she is again. She talks about the health impacts. She shows a wonderful picture, and notice the citation for the picture there. She talks about another impact. It's a little bit hard to see on the picture, but she's holding up some shrimpies. Hatcheries versus farmed fishing. And then a picture that she got off of the internet, off of the web. Another one. And here she is holding up a crab. Summary sheet, never forget the summary. And then since she was doing the presentation in class, she had a slide to remind herself to ask if there were any questions. And then notice how many sources that she has. So, you know, all kinds of pictures, the information that she has. Third from the bottom is the class. And she linked this to water pollution because obviously water, and all of the other and herself there is right in the middle almost, Alder MK 2017, as an unpublished manuscript from Colorado Technical University. So yes, you can cite yourself and put it into the references also. And interestingly, as soon as it's put onto the portal, it becomes a published document. Hackers can get their paws on it. So you could technically say it's a published manuscript. So, okay, so let's stop that share. So once again, any questions about, once again, I rely on Trent who actually moves. And
so how many slides? I have a question, how many slides?
As many as it takes. You know, I always tell you this because you always ask. So, you know, on the sheet of paper, it says, let's see, what does it say? Oh, I guess I closed that one out. That was stupid of me to do that. There we go.
Well, the reason I asked, because you say more reference, more points, so maybe more slides and more pictures.
That can have a correlation. Yes, it absolutely can. So let's see. I have on the piece of paper that you need a title page slide, research question slide, an interesting project slide. Sometimes people combine those two. So a background info slide, a results slide, a summary slide, and a reference slide. So minimally 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 slides would be the minimum you would be able to get away with. So did that help at all?
Yes.
Okay, good. Any other questions? We will be talking about this repeatedly. Like I said, you know, I like to sneak this into the background of your mind. And so that you'll be thinking about it while you're asleep, if no other time. And then you still have, you know, this is week 4, it's due on week 9, you still have 5 weeks. And I do know, because I've been doing this for a few years, that a certain number of people will be doing this on Tuesday morning on week 9. So, okay. No questions. Let's see if I can find my screen again. Okay, so can you see the project?
Yeah.
Okay, good. From current slide, I think, I don't know where it is. So.
I'm standing up because I'm not comfortable sitting down. Now you talk about eat too much.
Excuse me. Well, if we notice you laying on the floor, are we supposed to dial 911? So, okay. So again, you can find some examples out on my website. And I always say, do not plagiarize your project. I don't guarantee that I can find every plagiarized project out there, but if, for example, on the Turnitin score, you have a 98% and you have no citations, you can be pretty certain that you didn't come up with it all on your own. So again, on week 10 will be the project analyses. So any questions? I can't see Trent right now, but Peyton did slightly shake her head side to side. So.
No questions.
Resume slideshow. Maybe that's what I want.
Yes.
No. All right. Do you guys see land use, resource management, and agriculture?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Because, you know.
It just doesn't want to present. It's fine.
There we go. Ha! Yay. Okay. Now things look like they used to look. So. That didn't work. Oh, look, there's more people. Okay, so land use. This one's an easy one. It's how we use the land. We're, of course, in this class interested in how it impacts on human health and how it impacts on the environment, the Earth's health, as it were. We have what are called protected areas, natural parks, that have a legal designation in whatever jurisdiction they're under that recognizes that they have a certain value and need to be protected from being destroyed. As of October 2010, the last time they did one of these surveys, they'll probably be doing another one this year, there were over 161,000 protected land areas in the world. That was 10 to 15% of the world's surface area. Now, when I saw that, I was totally bowled over. I would have guessed about 1,000 protected land areas representing about 0.0001% of the Earth's surface. But no, it's actually a fairly large amount of the Earth's surface that is protected. So why is everything getting all torn up? Well, because protected is kind of a squishy word. In the oceans, much, much less, as you can imagine. 6,800 marine protected areas, just over 1% of the world's oceans. And as I think you can imagine, protection for the oceans is even squishier than protection for the land. Remember, in America, we have what are called conserved areas. Most of our national parks are conserved areas. People can still do limited agriculture, limited ranching, limited mining in a conserved area. So protection is kind of a not very protected word. So project question one, the land area 10 to 15% is protected, whereas only 1% of the oceans are protected. So hopefully everybody's got your homework assignment for week 4, due week 5 open so you can be answering these questions. Yeah, Trent says yep. Wake is having trouble keeping her eyelids open.
I'm sitting now.
I know you're sitting, but I saw blink, blink, blink. Okay, so that was
blink use.
Now we're going to do resource management. Remember, resources were not what I consider resources to be. I'm going to just use them as the way I think them. So resource management is using natural resources in ways that don't deplete them, what we would call in this class sustainable use. So for homework, one of the things you guys looked into was the Burren in Western Ireland. And this is the Burren. It's not nearly as green as we typically view Ireland as being. So would somebody like to tell me what's up with the Burren?
That was on the homework?
Yeah, well, I think there's some confusion on that one.
Maybe not.
So I don't think so.
Yeah, let me look quick.
Doesn't ring a bell.
You know, because I'm having you guys do extra things, maybe that was one of the things that got deep sixed. So, yeah, so that got replaced by the ecological footprint, it looks like. So okay, I get to tell you about the Burren then. So the Burren is an area in Western Ireland, as you can tell. It used to be forested and very, very green. And when I say used to be, we're talking about the Stone Age here. At the time when humans first began doing agriculture, and this would have been about 10,000 BC or so, and the people who were living in Western Ireland were beginning to do agriculture too. And of course, all those trees get in the way. So just like in the eastern United States, they chopped down all the trees and planted their farms. The problem was that unlike the eastern United States, where our topsoil goes down, you know, probably 12 to 20 feet, in the Burren area of Ireland, the topsoil only went down about 6 inches. So very quickly, the topsoil eroded away, leaving rocks behind. And so, of course, now basically nothing grows in the Burren of Western Ireland. And this was an ecological disaster that was caused by humans, but it was caused by Stone Age humans who literally did not know any better. So it just shows that we have had an effect for many, many years. You know, I said a couple of weeks ago that, you know, it's really only been since there's been so many of us that we could cause trouble. But obviously in our local areas, we could cause trouble clear back into the Stone Age.
How big is it?
I don't have the faintest idea. So somebody can quick Google, how big is the Burren? So resource management, that's obviously my trees are chopping off the bottom of management, but that's management there. So we talked about how in America, there were a lot of laws to encourage people to move west and farm. They were all farmers. And of course, they too would immediately chop down all the trees. And so in the mid-1800s, people began to worry that we weren't going to have any forests anymore. And they knew that we needed wood. And so they put together a variety of laws to encourage people to plant trees so that we wouldn't have a timber famine, they called it. They also, at the end of the Civil War, began to establish national forests. So our next question. So what are some non-renewable natural resources that we have?
Oil, fossil fuels, timber and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, oh. pretty much everything we don't manufacture, so. I watch all of these jewelry shows on television because Boake and I are jewelry addicts. And possibly some other of you ladies and gentlemen too. But it's interesting to me because, for example, tanzanite is a bluish purple stone that's very, very popular, especially for wedding rings. And the mine opened, I think it was in the 1970s, and already it's mined out. And so many of the jewels, pink diamonds, champagne diamonds, the green chrome diopside, all of these stones have been mined out. And some of them can't be found in various places on the earth. If you're talking about amethyst, that can be found just about every place. But tanzanite is named tanzanite because it's found in Tanzania and no place else. And so it's obviously a non-renewable resource. When it's mined out, it's gone. What are some potentially renewable resources?
Did you get to your class this morning?
Huh?
Did you do your class this morning?
Yeah.
So I got hope you were out. So, to your procedures.
So Peyton's talking, but she's not talking about renewable resources.
He's not with us.
So I'm waiting and crickets are chirping. And,
so what's the question?
What are some potentially renewable natural resources?
Basically things that can regenerate itself. Like you have listed freshwater, soil, rangeland kind of goes with soil. It's things that can reproduce on their own.
Right. And why do I say potentially?
Well, you can always damage the freshwater or run out of it. Non-extinct species can turn into extinct.
Yep.
You can always damage what you have so it does not reproduce.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the world we're living in right now, is there's a whole bunch of stuff that if we keep going the way we're going, is not going to be able to renew and refresh itself. So that's why we're paying attention to it now, is that hopefully that horrible situation will not happen. So that's question number four.
All right. Sorry about that.
No problem. That's the fun of being in these classes now. You know, in an actual classroom situation, students are still affected by the outside world, but they get a phone call and they dash out of the room. But, you know, here we actually live it with you. So
I don't know if one of you guys see one of the new broadcasts that this lady, she was doing new. And her dad was, he had a very big belly, and he came out from the hallway. He was pick up his shirt and rub on his belly, and she was screaming, and she started saying, "Holy crap, Dad!"
It's like the one of the newscaster that the husband's like doing a newscast or something.
You know, he was like.
That is the interesting thing. You know, the whole world is on Zoom right now, and we've been finding all of these problems. And I was, like I said, I was watching one of these jewelry channels the other day, and they were trying to do a Zoom chat with all of their salespeople at home and the one lady in the studio. And just like what the problem that we had a couple of weeks ago when I tried to be on in two locations, we were getting that feedback from the mic. They were getting the same thing. And I was like, I know how you guys can fix this. But of course, they didn't ask me. So as I mentioned, agriculture was one of the very first things that humans invented, not the first thing, but originally humans were hunter-gatherers. And we typically, in our modern minds, we view the men going out hunting and the women gathering vegetables and fruits and things like that. But it's beginning to look like the reality was much more mixed, that women were hunters too, and some of the men who were not adept hunters or were too young or too old would be gathering too. The first things that humans invented were, of course, tools to help with this hunting and gathering. So let's look at the top left-hand picture there. What do you think that is?
It looks like the shape of the almond.
Yep, it's shaped like an almond, but it's not. What do you think it is?
I want to say it's one of those rocks that was used like to carve the meat, like the early stages of the knife.
Yeah. So you notice they've actually chipped this stone, and not every rock will do this. So the first thing that humans had to learn was which rocks will sharpen and which rocks won't. And of course, that's not difficult to do. Probably originally they were crossing a stream and somebody looked down and there was a broken rock and they went, "Oh, look at that sharp edge. I can use that." And then somebody else said, "Gee, I wonder if I could make that happen." And so you knock rocks together until you get sharp rocks. This actually, it looks a little bit like what we would call an arrowhead, but it's not actually. It's actually the same size as the palm of your hand. So stick the palm of your hand out where that is, and you can see that on your computer, it's actually probably about a little bit too small for the size it is. This is actually a stone axe, and it would have been used in exactly the same way we use axes nowadays. Right next to it, to the right, is a scraper, and that would have been used after you had hunted the animal and you skin the animal, and this scrapes the skin off. And you can also use it if you want to scrape the fur off of the skin and use the non-furry skin for clothing or whatever. The bottom left one is a chopper. So that would be used if you had like nuts or something and you wanted to chop them. The one immediately to the right of that is a drill.
It's a grinder, isn't it? For like a mortar and pestle?
No, they didn't have mortars and pestles at that point. This is just, think of it as being very thin rather than round. I know it looks round, but it's actually very thin. And so they would use it like if you were making clothing and you wanted to have a belt that went through the clothing, that would have been used to make the hole for the belt to go through. And then the one finally on the far right, that's an actual point. So the points were actually as small as they could be, as light as they could be, and they didn't use them as arrowheads. These were spear points. So that's the toolkit of the hunter-gatherer. This is the toolkit of the agriculturalist. We call it the Agpo era in archaeology. Agriculture and Po is pottery because they came about at the same time. And this is kind of universal. We don't think of them as the same thing, but somehow every place invented pottery at exactly the same time they were inventing agriculture. So obviously on the left, you have a pottery container. And that would have been used, of course, by ancient people to put their grains and such in to keep rodents and other nasty things out. This would have been when cats entered the lives of human beings because they came into the caves or wherever people were living to keep out the rodents, and people welcomed them. Dogs had been hanging with people for as long as people were living in small groups, and they chased predators away in exchange for human scraps. So I always say that cats were more like outside consultants, whereas dogs were part of the family. What do you think the thing on the right is?
Like a saw?
A saw, very good, yeah. What do you think it's made out of?
Bone.
It could be a jawbone with teeth in it, or a stick with rocks.
It looks like sharp teeth.
Jawbone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you guys would make very good ancient agriculturalists. You have good instincts. This one is actually made out of an antler, and they've cut little holes, kind of a ridge on one side of the antler, and they've put in, those are actually like... we would call them arrowheads. They were stone points, technically. And then they're glued in with tree sap. That's the black stuff. So that was actually a very ancient sickle or scythe. Some people call it a scythe. So it would be used to cut plants. So for almost three quarters of our existence, humans have been farmers. Now, they've found recently some evidence that humans are actually much more ancient than we thought, so maybe it's only a half. But for a very large part of our existence, humans have been farmers. And I don't know why that's there. That's wrong. Yes, I guess that is right. Okay. So... land use, and of course most of what human land use is going to be agriculture. So land use over time. Now, let me see if I can get you guys out of the... Okay, so this would have been, you notice down in the lower left-hand corner, it says 9,000 years BP, stands for before present. So in other words, about 7,000 BC. What we're going to do is we're going to highlight in increasingly yellow human land use. So I think you can see 7,000 BC, not much. So here's 8,000. It just changes the teeniest, tiniest bit. Can you see that little bit of a change? I'm going to highlight it right there. So these are the places that in about 6,000 BC, humans were already living there and practicing agriculture. 7,000 BC, we noticed the first agriculture in Europe, and we noticed big time in the Americas, South America particularly, and also in Mexico. 6,000, notice it's really heating up in China. 5,000,
India.
4,000, 3,000, 2,000. So you'll notice that people are not expanding out, they're intensifying where they are for the most part. 1,000, and now this is year 500 AD. So we're just getting rid of the Romans, and we're moving into what are called the Dark Ages. That was BP before president. So that would have been 1500. I'm sorry. Okay, that was 1500. And then this is 360 years ago. Notice for the first time, instead of getting yellower, it got greener. Now, obviously in Europe, it got yellower, but let's look at the Americas particularly. So this was 1500, basically before the Europeans got here. This is after the Europeans got here. What happened in the Americas?
A lot of it went back to the natural vegetation.
Uh-huh. Why did it do that?
Oh, because you're looking at roughly the 1700s, right?
Let's see. This would have been 1640. So time of the pilgrims.
Mm-hmm. Oh, plague, famine.
Yeah.
They're killing each other off.
The Europeans didn't just bring themselves to America. They brought all kinds of things that the Americans were not immune to. So this was 1500. This was 1640. That many people died off, and Native American people died off and could no longer have the agriculture they had before. And there weren't enough Europeans to take over that that area. Yay.
Well, and the Spanish had gone to Central America and to Mexico, too, and they brought a lot.
Exactly. Spanish, so notice again, here's Mexico in 1500, Mexico in 1640. Those Europeans, they cause all the kinds of problems.
Well, you also have India that's growing red.
Yes.
Because that was about the time that, I lost my train of thought.
That's okay. But no, that was about the time that the British stormed through India also. Mm-hmm. Now notice we still don't have any agriculture per se in Australia. The native people in Australia never got into this whole idea of growing stuff. They had a perfectly balanced environment between people and the natural resources. They didn't have to. So this was about 1900. About 1920, about 1940, about 1960. Notice the huge difference. 1960, we were beginning to have what was called the Green Revolution. We'll be chatting about that in a bit. 1980. And this would have been about the year 2000. So, any questions about land use, natural resources? Back to agriculture again. So this was a guy, Peter Menzel, in 2007. he published a book called Hungry Planet, and he went around to all over the world, and he would ask people to, you know, bring all of your food into one location. He did it later with all of their stuff, and, you know, people would bring all of their furniture and everything into one location, and then he would photograph it. A typical family in the United States, a typical family in Japan, typical family in Guatemala, typical family in Mali, and show just, you know, visually how these different people live. What would you use to describe the food in the United States?
Prepackaged.
A lot of prepackaged stuff, yep.
Mm-hmm. Process. I think it's like more advanced, but it's like it's using more of that food and changing it from its original state. So it's like kind of like advanced timeline, but not necessarily like advanced health wise, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Notice, you know, they've got some meat, but it's in a package. They've got some, it looks like apples or tomatoes or something back on the counter, but notice they have a sticker on them. So even a tomato has been processed in some way. How about Japan?
Japan is the same.
Not that far off.
Right. Yeah, we don't notice any pizza boxes there, but it also is little packages of things. And you notice the melon, the bananas, not only do they have a sticker on them, but you can't see it on the melon, but it's absolutely true. I've lived in Japan and you buy nothing that isn't wrapped in, you know, plastic and usually a styrofoam container behind it. So everything is processed. How about Guatemala?
A lot of fresh stuff.
That's a healthy food right there.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like there's much meat, though.
Not much meat, no. Can anybody see any meat at all?
No.
No. Mm-hmm. Now, they do have some packaged stuff, too. Notice they've got a container with probably oil in it next to the kids in the back. And right in front of that, some little packages of stuff. In Central America, they have little chips and things that they like a lot. Other than that, it's pretty much natural. How about Mali?
Most of that
isn't much.
Not much, yeah.
Grains.
That's the best descriptor,
it's a lot
yeah.
more grain, yeah.
So it looks like they have things in containers, but that's all they are. They're containers. That's the water that they've gotten probably from the river, because I noticed some green in the background, so there probably is a river there. And all of the containers that they have are water containers.
A lot of perishables.
What was that, Trent?
A lot of them perishables, too.
Yeah, exactly. And as you mentioned, not much of even that. So I asked the question, who would you hope invites you to dinner?
U.S.
Japan.
Yeah, this depends on your personal preference. Some people say United States because they like pizza. So.
Well, you also have to think like the difference between the U.S. and Japan is also a cultural thing. Mm-hmm. The U.S. has a lot more like immigration of foods and different things, while Japan is still just what they have, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Less international.
Yeah.
I also love in Japan, they got a TV in the background, and what looks like a vampire is obviously advertising something.
Dude, some of their ads are crazy.
Oh, they are indeed. Have you lived there too, Peyton?
No.
Oh, okay.
I've been on the internet for over 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
Find some weird things.
And then I think I ask, who do you hope does not invite you to dinner? And, you know, I love couscous, so I love the food in Mali. I lived in Mali also for 6 months. But I hope they don't invite me because I don't want to be eating these people's food. So I always joke, you know, when you're in Africa, you always make sure that you bring, you know, cookies and tea. And if anybody does invite you to their house, then you have something, you know, if they're going to be giving you tea, and then you can give them tea to replace that tea plus a little more, and cookies, and that way they won't be out anything by inviting you to dinner. Okay, so once more I have to move you guys. Agriculture since 1798, when Population was written by Malthus, has been a race to feed the world. Remember Paul Ehrlich in Population Bomb predicted widespread starvation in the 1970s as the population outgrew its food supply. Well, that never actually happened. In fact, the human population actually increased more than he predicted, but we've reduced hunger by about half, 26% of the world's population in 1970 to 13%. In 2000. So how did we do that? We had what was called the Green Revolution, where science stepped in and said, we can help on this one. I went to school for my undergraduate at Colorado State University, and it's a land-grant institution. That means it's given its property by the United States government in order that it will train people how to do scientific agriculture. And this, of course, dates from the early 1900s, so their definition of scientific agriculture was real different back then. But the Green Revolution was characterized by the synthetic fertilizer that Fritz Haber invented back in the 1915-16 time period, where he pulls nitrogen out of the air. It's characterized by a strong use of pesticides to get rid of insects and lizards and mammals, all kinds of critters that eat crops. It's characterized by irrigation, by use of fossil fuels for tractors and creating the synthetic fertilizers and the pesticides and the irrigation. It's characterized by what are called high responders. These are not necessarily genetically modified organisms, but they're seeds that have been carefully selected to have a high yield. And it's also characterized by what's called a monoculture, where, for example, all of the wheat plants from northern Texas through southern Canada will be the same wheat plant because it's that high responder that's been developed to give high yields. That's your question 7. Hopefully you noticed that. I was typing frantically. But of course, we all know there's always a downside to everything. And the downside to the Green Revolution was pollution, as you used more and more fossil fuels to run your giant tractors. We have something we see here in Colorado all the time. It's called salinization and desertification. So as you do irrigation, if you over irrigate and it's, you know, it's an exact amount that the plants want. If you put too much in, what happens is that the excess water that's not being absorbed by the plants will actually dissolve salts that occur in every soil. And salts are lighter than water, so they actually float to the top. And you actually see areas where the soil has no plants growing on it and it's got white on the top of it, that's salt. And that's what we call salinization. And if you have that over a wide enough area for a long enough period of time, nothing will grow there and you get what's called desertification. Like I said, this is very common in Colorado. When I was young, just north of where North Glen is now was a big area that they had overwatered and it was just pure white and nothing would grow there. They, of course, wanted to turn it into homes with lawns and things like that. And so what they had to actually do was go and scrape that salty soil off, haul it away in trucks to who knows where, and then put in new topsoil. Obviously, that's expensive. You only do it when you think you can make more money selling the real estate than it's going to cost you to do this for the soil. Obviously, if you're only planting one wheat plant from northern Texas to southern Canada, you have reduced biodiversity. And that's going to mean that if there is a pest or a disease that really likes that one variety of wheat, you are sunk. And it also means that since only certain things are grown, only certain things can be eaten by humans. So that was question number 8. An example of the last one was 1970. Every corn plant in the United States was actually a clone of each other. They weren't just different seeds. They were physically the same plant that had been cloned in a lab and planted all over the United States. And it just happened there was a particular, it's called corn blight. It changes, as you can see in the middle corn ear very well, it changes the normal yellow seeds into giant bluish black ugly, nobody's going to eat that seeds. And that hit all of the corn in 1970. In 1976, yes, 1976, I was, now 1976, 1980, there we go. I was working for the U.S. government and we were doing the yields of wheat and corn and all of the United States food crops over the years. And they told me, do not include 1970 when you're doing corn because that was the year of the corn blight. So I, of course, immediately looked into it. And yeah, the corn yield went down to really, really pathetic that year. So how can we support the planet, the farmer, people who eat stuff? Obviously, we did the best we could when we did the Green Revolution to support the farmer and the people who eat stuff, but unfortunately, it wasn't supportive of the planet. So we need to come up with ways that the farmer can still make a good living, people can still, or actually eat better foods than we were during the Green Revolution, where we tended to eat a lot of potato chips, and make the planet a better place too. So, going back to the basics of agriculture, plants need water. When I worked for the U.S. government, one of the things we were doing was putting together mathematical models, computer models, to estimate what yields were going to be based on the weather. That was what I did then when I worked at Hershey Foods Corporation, and what I did when I worked again with the government more recently. And when we put together these models, we would include, you know, how much water, how much sun, the temperatures, the wind, natural soil nutrients, whether people were using fertilizer, any pests they might be having. And we found that pretty much you could ignore everything except water. Water was the big one. If the plants get enough water, they'll do well. If the plants don't get enough water, they won't. But these are all the things that plants need and were the things that we included in our models. If water is available, then if you have improved irrigation, you can grow food on more land. You can, using irrigation, have plants growing even in years when you're not getting enough water. And farmers can make a good living. In ancient Egypt, the agriculture obviously revolved around the annual flooding of the Nile. That became the basis for the religion. The Maya of Central America, where you don't have one big river going through, and you have frequent droughts, so they would have giant cisterns. This, for example, the square in the middle would be about 6 foot square. The hole in the center would be about 3 foot square. So I think you can see these are huge. Frequently, the Maya cities were totally paved, not because they didn't like plants, but the city would be a giant cistern. So in a way, our modern cities are this way. Most of the rain that falls lands on paved areas and goes into our storm sewer system. So the Mayas were using their storm sewer system as the source of not only water for their crops, but also for their just livelihoods. But what happens if there's no water, which is what happens in most of the sub-Saharan African countries that I work with all the time? In Western Asia and North Africa, they developed a system called a variety of things. They're well-like vertical shafts connected by tunnels. And the tunnels had to be dug by hand underground. So this is how these things look. You'll start out with a source of water somewhere, either a natural well or an area in the mountains, for example, that gets rainfall all the time. And then you have a tunnel that goes out from that has a slight, very slight downward tilt. And then everybody in between those two places can dig a well and access the water. At the very bottom is where the water is going to come out as a hole and irrigate land. And these were probably constructed between about 500 BC and about 1500 AD, and they're so well constructed that they're still used today. Possibly some of you who were in Iraq might have seen some of this stuff. But on the left, you can see this is, you know, how close they stuck the wells together. You can see a plowed field off to the side, give you some idea of the scale. And then these are dug, you know, frequently in stone. This is a lot of work to build this system. And you can see that then on the right. And here's where it comes to the surface in Tehran, and it's used to irrigate the plants in the park in the National Library. If water is not available, for example, in eastern Colorado, originally we did not have the deep wells that they have nowadays, so they practiced what was called dry land farming, or no-till or low-till. Dryland farming, one of the things you do is you leave the crop residue across the winter, and that catches the snow as it blows by, And it also gives sort of a terracing effect to prevent runoff. You plant seeds at whatever depth the moisture exists, and that usually means it's very deep. And you use crop varieties that are drought and heat tolerant. These are not GMO varieties. These are the native varieties, or the ones that are drought and heat resistant. So that was the dryland farming strategies. Includes the windbreaks that you leave the residue in, but also you make fences, and you can sometimes see these. They'll build them along highways to keep the snow from going over the highway. That's a windbreak. You can spread straw that keeps the moisture in, and with what's called strip farming, where you'll have, I'll show you a picture. Okay. There we go, strip farming. So you can see the plants are actually planted in the furrow, and then you have a high space in between them that keeps the wind off of the plants, so less evaporation, and also because they're in kind of a trench, any moisture that there is accumulates in the trench. So, let's see, what did I skip? Okay, so now we've got no-till, low-till, and this is about how often you drive your tractor over the area. So no-till, obviously, the answer is never. Low-till is when you plant and at no other time. And that, again, helps to minimize soil erosion. What about high-tech gadgets? Well, that's, of course, what we got nowadays. We in the United States have and can afford these high-tech gadgets like center pivot irrigation. If you fly over eastern Colorado, you'll see little green circles. In each field is a little green circle, and then there's a little kind of triangle of dead tan in between them. That happens because they have irrigation that's the sprinkler is tied to a center point, and it walks around in a circle around that center point. So we have two examples of that here. The one on the top left is one that would be used in an area that you don't get a whole lot of evaporation. So this would not be an eastern Colorado center pivot irrigation system. The one on the bottom right, that's an eastern Colorado system. You notice you don't spray water into the air, because when you spray water into the air, it has a higher likelihood of evaporating. So it just trickles out, little drips, not, you know, a whole bunch. It just trickles out of these hoses as the thing walks around. And that way it's going right into the root area of the plants, and you get the minimum amount of evaporation. So what are some problems with high-tech gadgets?
Maintenance.
Maintenance, you got it. Stuff like that breaks a lot. What else?
Expensive.
Yeah. You're going to have this in eastern Colorado. You're not going to have this in Bangladesh. Anything else? So, in Bangladesh, they came out with an amazing innovation. They spent $50 million on it for the entire country and increased farm income annually by $150 million. It's utilized by 1.5 million farmers. So we're splitting that $50 million over 1.5 million farmers. So what any ideas? Once again, Trent shakes his head, and I am paying attention to Trent. It was a foot-powered pump.
Oh, I know someone like that.
Yeah. So they get their exercise. I doubt that they need it, but they get their exercise, and you can get the water up from the subsoil into the area where the plants are.
That's a gym right there.
Yeah, it is. That's your gym.
You got the torso and body work out.
Exactly.
You don't know, is that?
And your plants do well too.
Yeah.
So this one is what we actually used in Central America. This is in Nepal. In our farm in Central America, the rain, wherever it is put into the container, which is elevated, and then once again it goes down a hose and slowly drips into the plant root area where it's needed. And of course, something like this costs practically nothing. So low tech sometimes is better. And we have managed to increase the world's food supply, but nations such as India, and you know, picture India, you know, okay, there are some very, very large cities, but for the most part, people are farmers. And even at that, they can't feed all of their people.
But it's because they're so overpopulated.
Right. You know, it's not like Malthus was wrong. You can overpopulate an area and not be able to feed yourself, even with the best of techniques. So we're going to, let's take our break now, and we'll do soil conservation when we get back. So let's see, somewhere I could turn off the recording and not record for 10 minutes of blackness. In the meantime, and nothing happens. That's it. Pause on. Yay! All right. So do you guys still have the PowerPoint up?
You know. But I don't know if you're sharing your screen or not.
So hopefully it's there now.
Yeah, now it is.
Okay, good. So, soil is a limited resource, and we need it for agriculture, but also agriculture impacts the soil. And probably the major impacts are erosion, as we, particularly here in Colorado, you could see that when Europeans first came to Colorado, there were short grasses covering the entire plains area, and that kept the wind from blowing the soil away. Periodically it would burn, but it wouldn't burn to the point where there weren't the roots and so on to keep the soil locked in. As soon as the Europeans came with their plows and broke up that soil, it began to blow. We know what happens on that. And obviously, we've already talked about salinization and desertification when you try to over-irrigate an area. Some soil conservation strategies include growing different crops every year, because typically crops will mine certain elements out of the soil, particularly nitrogen, and so you can plant certain crops like soybeans and other types of beans that will replenish the nutrients in the soil. Contour farming, where you plow not in long straight lines from one edge of Colorado to the other, you sort of plow in the way the topography goes. So around hills and alongside rivers, and if there's nothing there, you plow in non-straight lines anyway. Intercropping. This one is the one that the farmers don't really like to do. What that means is that you have two crops planted together. That's what the American Indians used to do. They would have a row of corn, maize, and a row of beans. And that way, they sort of protect each other. The nutrients from one spread over to the other. Like I said, American farmers don't like to do that because the machinery for one crop can't be used on another crop. So they don't like that. No-till, low-till, obviously, reducing the amount of irrigation that you use, and dry land farming. So, you guys are now experts on this. So let's stop sharing and see if you guys would like to tell me about the Dust Bowl.
Dust Bowl is bad.
Dust Bowl bad, yes. I think that's it.
Cause people
most to things have a good side and a bad side. The Dust Bowl does not. So.
Nobody want to live under the dust.
That's right. Yeah, you guys were watching a different video. Usually I have the PBS video that I can show in class, but it doesn't work with Zoom. It fights happily. And so you guys were watching a PBS video from Colorado. So let's see, what questions do I ask you about this? I ask, that was last week's. No wonder I was confused. Let's see. Oh, that is what I want, last week's. So, what's the dry?
Baca County.
Yeah, you it's got it.
Very southeastern corner of the state.
Right. Why could black people settle there?
There's no discrimination. They didn't tell them they couldn't. Plus, it was freedom. They could own property. They weren't being ridiculed.
Yeah. So it was less of a they could versus why did they want to.
What was that, Peyton? I didn't hear you.
I said it was a less of why could they versus why would they want to.
Right. Why did they?
Just for those reasons. Like, there wasn't, they weren't seen as black anymore, I guess, in a way to put it.
Yeah, basically, it was a piece of real estate that nobody else wanted. So if you were stupid enough to want to live there, go for it. Let's see, what else do I ask? When did the Dust Bowl start?
31, I believe.
Yeah, about 1931. As they said, the first crop had gone south. It was
how
devastating.
Long did it last?
A decade?
1930s.
So I believe they said it lasted almost a decade. And then when I Googled it to get an actual year, because the video was like hard to get answers from every now and then.
It said about 1939 they got the first real rain for the season. So that kind of ended. Yeah, they didn't specify exactly.
Right, because, you know, it was a broad area, and it lasted different lengths of times in different places. So that's why I ask questions that have no real answer is, you know, Kaylee would go, but what's the real answer? And I would go, it's whatever you see. Now, this is the important one. Why did the Dust Bowl happen?
A lot of open farming and over improper farming.
Yeah. Overplowing.
And then plus they went into their cycle of having bad environment, like very few little rain.
Yeah.
It was a lethal combination between the drought and, of course, just the improper farming.
So let's just say poor farmer practice back then.
Yeah.
So they don't have a lot of experience doing the farming.
Yeah, with the, yeah, we talked about the new tractors and stuff last week, and suddenly they could basically plow everything. And they plowed a whole lot of land that shouldn't have been plowed, basically. So we leave a lot of land fallow nowadays that's not really suitable for farming, but they didn't back then. Tell me about dust pneumonia.
It was when dust settled into the lungs, causing numerous issues. Really, anything going into the lungs isn't a good thing, but dust especially, because air can't pass through it, so it would kind of clog all the bronchioles and all that, and yeah.
Yeah, in the video that you guys didn't get to see, they actually showed a extremely gross picture of a little kid coughing up something that looked the size and shape of a hot dog. That was yeah. It was the dust that had gotten into his largest bronchial tube and kind of solidified, and he managed to cough it up again. But yeah, bad stuff.
Yep.
Tell me about Black Sunday.
They didn't give much detail on it. They said they liked the animals and stuff. Obviously, we're going in the opposite direction, and then they saw the storm, and that they knew it was going to be bad, and then it changed subjects. So.
Yeah, this wasn't the perfect video, but there was actually a better video out there, but the sound was so low, and it was all black and white, and it was fuzzy, 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 and I thought, well, you know, it's the Colorado one is not as good in terms of information, but the quality is, it won't drive you crazy, so. And it was shorter, too. That's always nice, too. When did Black Sunday happen?
It didn't tell us.
It didn't state exactly. They just said it was one of the worst dust storms that they had recorded of the Dust Bowl.
Yeah, that's right. And I will be covering it just a little bit, so you'll be able to hear when it was in a little bit. Where did the term Dust Bowl come from?
A news reporter.
Robert Geiger, he was a reporter.
Here we go. What's an out-migration?
The opposite of immigration?
It is.
people from a title state into the same country, not like leave the country.
Right.
So I got the Black Sunday as April 14th, 1935.
There you go. So where did the out-migrators go to?
Anywhere else.
I think I remember reading Oklahoma, one of them.
California.
Texas.
They came from Oklahoma. That's why they called them the Okies. And they mostly went to California. Now, picture California in the 1940s, and picture a whole bunch of Okies landing there with no money.
Yeah.
Kind of
what it looks like today. Sorry,
Lisa, go ahead. So what kind of looks like today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So were the Okies welcome in California or no?
Not really. It was a big kind of cultural difference too.
Oh yeah. Huge, huge. Why did some people stay?
Because they didn't have anything else to leave to and they were hard-headed.
Too broke to move?
Yeah.
Or they had a good business and they didn't need to. Like the shop owners and stuff like that.
Well, remember, this was the Depression. I don't think anybody had a good business, but certainly...
They didn't have to leave, though.
Good, better than some people, yeah.
The people that owned livestock could stay because they could survive off their own stock.
Yeah.
We're actually going to see something about that later. So it was Colorado was apparently different on that. At last, I ask you to tell me about the Soil Conservation Service.
Help farmers develop new, more environmentally sensitive farm.
Gave them different ways of farming and stuff.
Planting a lot more trees and grass.
Okay, good stuff, everybody. Hopefully everybody found their animal. And so Diana, you might be the one who was most badly affected by that. Did you know to go out to X stuff? There's an assignment called X stuff, extra stuff at the end of the assignment sheet. And then go on the grade sheet to extra stuff. And I have a posting there that had your secret number and your secret animal. And that was part of the homework. So.
Okay.
Good. Okay. So I'm going to... See, that doesn't look good, but that's all I've got. So let's go with that. Oh, that is the Dust Bowl. How nice. Can you guys see the Dust Bowl?
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So now I'm going to tell you some lesser known effects of the Dust Bowl. And... especially since some of you go over these later with your kids. Some of these are a little bit disturbing for children. So you might want to send them to the refrigerator right now or something. Dust pneumonia. This was, again, one of the things that the American Red Cross was sort of put in charge of, finding dust masks, that's what they called them at that time, and issuing them to children in the schools. This was mostly in Kansas where this was a problem. And here's a school picture. It looks a little bit like life in 2020. Now notice there's a teacher in the back and he doesn't have a mask on. That's because dust pneumonia really only harmed children. It was like 90% children who died from it. So the teachers didn't need to be wearing a dust mask, and the kids did. The kids who were interviewed said that they felt like they couldn't breathe with the mask on. So even though to us it looks flimsy compared to our modern face masks, they thought that was pretty awful that they had to do that. Oops. Here's some home remedies that the kids told that their parents were using for dust pneumonia. They rubbed skunk grease on their chests. And apparently skunk grease actually smells like skunks. So they were not happy about that. They said their mom would give them a spoonful of sugar with a drop of turpentine in it or a drop of kerosene. And of course, turpentine and kerosene are both poisonous and taste very bad, so you put sugar so that they can't taste it. And then they would mix kerosene with lard and rub that on their chest, and then you would smell like gasoline basically all day. So kids just absolutely hated all of these. And of course, just like now we're having trouble finding something that actually works with COVID-19. None of these things would actually do any good, but it gave mom the idea that she was doing the best she could for her children. So, and about 7,000 people, again, especially small children, lost their lives to dust pneumonia. This is one that you never hear about. The jackrabbits normally have enough food that they don't have to eat everything on the farms. Well, there wasn't any natural food for them, and there wasn't any food on the farms for them because it had all died too. So it was just, people would say you would be standing, say, on a hill, and you would look down into the valley, and suddenly the valley would move like it was an ocean. And it was just, you know, wall-to-wall jackrabbits running like mad. Any vegetation that there was, of course, the jackrabbits would eat, and they would get into barns and eat anything that was stored in the barns. So they were a real problem. So they began to have jackrabbit roundups, and you notice this ground cover is all dead jackrabbits, and all around the fence are jackrabbits hung. And this looks just awful, of course, from the jackrabbit devastation point of view. But also, remember, people didn't have anything to eat. So this at least gave people something to eat when they would have one of these roundups. They were saying that the first roundups, they would chase the jackrabbits into this pen, and then the men would stand on the side and shoot them. Well, of course, that was a really bad idea because, you know, somebody is standing on the opposite side of the pen might get shot too. So then they changed. Instead of shooting them, they would go in and club them to death with sticks or axe handles or whatever they had laying around. So, you know, definitely something the SPCA would not have approved of, but at least it did give people something to eat. A lot of jackrabbit stew recipes at that time, I bet. And I'm betting jackrabbits don't taste very good either. Now, somebody mentioned that ranchers at least could eat their cattle. Well, the problem was there was nothing for the cattle to eat. And so the cattle got skinnier and skinnier and skinnier. And so the U.S. government had what they called a cattle culling program, where they would buy $16 for a cow, $3 for a calf from farmers, a cow that was, you know, so hungry and dehydrated it can no longer produce milk. And that was the thing that was the most controversial because, you know, these animals, the cow who gave you milk, that was like a member of your family. And one of the guys described it that, you know, you see the government leading her away and, you know, she's going to die. Well, how long do you have? So about 250,000 people fled. Again, this is one of those things that we have no clue how many people actually fled the plains. Some people say as much as 2.5 million. This is not something that, you know, was on the census at that time. But this was 250 is the low end, and 2.5 is probably the high end. This is, of course, the most famous picture. Dorothea Lange was sort of the photographer of the Dust Bowl, and this is one of her most famous photographs. This is another one of her photographs. People would, when they would leave their homes, they would just throw everything they could onto their car and take the family, and they would, you know, flee. As you mentioned, you know, where do we flee to? Well, maybe you might have some relatives somewhere. You were going to end up with them. In the meantime, you would get together in Okey camps, they called them, where, you know, everybody would be camped together for safety. but some were hanging on. Here's a bird's nest. This actually was a U.S. government photograph. They were actually called out that this bird, there not being anything else to, no sticks to make a bird's nest out of, the bird had made the nest out of barbed wire. They had what was called the Last Man's Club, where you signed a not very binding document that said, you know, as long as my family can survive, I'm going to hang on. And obviously, if your family wasn't surviving, you were allowed to leave. And the slogan of the Last Man's Club was to grab a stick and growl. So a little bit like the howling that people are doing in Denver right now. So they're not doing that in my neighborhood. I'm kind of sad. So what were some of the less well-known effects of the Dust Bowl?
The pneumonia with all of its different cures, 7,000 deaths, and a jackrabbit invasion.
Mm-hmm. And the cattle calling.
Yeah.
Cattle calling.
Now, another one I didn't actually mention, the sand blowing and rubbing against each other actually formed static electricity, and people would get huge headaches from that. The static electricity would actually desiccate. It would pull the water out of anything that actually had water in it. So one of the guys was saying that he had... cucumbers. It was cucumbers he was growing, and he would bring water out from the house and water the cucumbers every day. And the static electricity in the air would desiccate, dry out the cucumbers. So even though he was watering them every day, they couldn't grow because they were dried out by the static electricity. So need to add that in, don't I? That's hard to have a picture of, static electricity. Okay, now where did it happen? The main ground zero was Oklahoma and the panhandle of Texas. Kansas, Colorado, New Mexico. They don't usually mention the other states, but I'm glad on this map, which actually dates from that time, that they do show it happening pretty much all of the Great Plains states. They even had a little bit in Arizona. It was happening, as I mentioned earlier, at the same time as the Great Depression. So the city folks who were elected to become congressmen and senators in Washington weren't paying much attention to it. They viewed it as, you know, part of the Great Depression and kind of an unimportant distraction, as opposed to, you know, the important stuff which was happening in the cities. But then suddenly it wasn't so far away. 1934, the Dust Bowl hit Chicago. Ooh. But of course, it wasn't there every day. So, you know, it happened once, okay. 1935, Hugh Bennett, remember he's the father of soil conservation? He's testifying before Congress to create the National Soil Conservation Service and get it funded. And he knew a dust storm was coming that was gonna hit Washington. So he blathered on and on and on, just to make sure that it would happen while he was talking. And it did. Mm. And the National Soil Conservation Service got created and funded. And this is, of course, the picture of FDR signing the Soil Conservation Act. Hugh Bennett is the one, the very far left back row.
One with the square face.
Yeah. Well, they all kind of have square faces, but yeah. kind of the ears sticking out on the side. Yeah, that's yum. And only 3 weeks later was Black Sunday, and pretty much nobody could ignore after Black Sunday that something just unprecedented was happening. So what are some surprising cities the Dust Bowl affected? And no, do not say Oklahoma City. That's not surprising. So I invariably have a student who puts in, you know, Tulsa, Oklahoma. No.
Chicago and D.C.
Yeah. Okay, so what was all of this soil conservation stuff? Well, what Hugh Bennett was advocating was contour plowing. And this is sort of the classic contour plowing. In the in normal times when we have the environmental science lab class, we actually throw beads on a table and do contour plowing versus straight plowing and run a hair dryer over it, and the beads fly all over the room. And this is why you find beads on every floor in CTU campus. Contour plowing keeps the dust from blowing away. And the really important thing, that the furrows that people were digging at that time, even though they were being done by tractors and could have been very deep, it takes longer time to plow deep furrows. So they were plowing pretty much 3-inch furrows, just enough that you could cover over the seeds, and they would grow without blowing away. But deep furrows, minimum 8 inches, recommended 12. And thanks to that and some of the other things that the Soil Conservation Service has come up with over the years, we've had droughts. For example, the year 2000 to 2013 drought, we never had another dust bowl. You occasionally have small dust storms locally, but no dust bowl. And Franklin D. Roosevelt, the guy who signed the service into business, says a nation that destroys its soil destroys itself. So, you survived another one, everybody. Oops, here's the last question. Why didn't we have another dust bowl? So you survived another week. And thanks again for coming. Gonna get out of here, get back to you guys. If anybody finds out who Kevin was, let me know.
Just come and disappear?
Pardon?
Did he just show up and disappear or something?
Yeah.
He showed up for an hour. He said hi, but he never said who he was. So, and I don't have a Kevin. And I looked, you know, like I said, sometimes people use other people's emails, and I don't have a Kevin on any of the emails. So I don't know who Kevin is.
Maybe hopefully. Your mystery man.
Mystery man. Yeah, exactly. They don't have mystery man on my my attendance sheet. So, but thanks everybody. And Diana, now you're caught up. You know how this all works, and hopefully it'll be easier than next week. So thanks, Trin. Take care.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Yeah, bye. Take care, everybody. Anybody who wants to hang around afterwards and chat, we can turn off the recording and do that. So.
Yeah, lonely, Vicky.
Take care, friends. Bye.
This corona got you lonely?
Yeah, people disappear and I say goodbye to them. Well, they're gone. I can't say goodbye to them. So, so Lisa, Trent, and Dee's gone.
Yep.
So, I did have a question about the project, because I'd had another class that was environmental study type based.
Sure, sure. Uh-huh.
And I'd done research on the Love Canal.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't sure if that would be on topic?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, it's a couple of possibilities. You know, we did history. You could use History Week. We'll be doing pollution. You can do Pollution Week. So, yeah, you can stick it under a variety of topics. Let me be honest. When I look, I just look to see that the class is I don't check to make sure that they picked the best topic for their citation. So,
yeah, no, this one was done. I forgot what I did it. Actually, I think I did it for a history teacher. Uh-huh. And it was from how the area was first, what had happened, how it turned into the situation that it did.
Yeah. That was what, wasn't that our first Superfund site? So,
yeah.
So it started a whole industry.
Kind of, I don't want to say it was the start of the EPA, but kind of really yeah. came out to the forefront and became the voice for those types of situations.
Exactly. No, I think that would be a wonderful one. And just make sure you add your two extra slides that you probably didn't need for your previous class. And
oh no, I just wrote the report. I never had to do a PowerPoint for it, so I've probably got all sorts of stuff for it.
Oh, great! And you can also, in fact, you should always cite yourself and cite that that you did it for that class. So, and that's perfectly okay. fine then when you do that. So, okay,
cool,
wonderful.
All right. Bye, you two. See you guys next week.
Bye, Trent. Bye. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Okay, it's just me. So, stop.